Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We are coming to you live from London. I'm Rob Young. And we start in Pakistan, where a powerful bomb blast at a railway station has killed 25 people and injured more than 40 others. The authorities say a suicide bomber detonated their device as passengers were waiting to board a morning train in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan in the southwest. Video footage shows scenes of chaos with bodies lying among the debris and part of the station roof hanging down. Abdul Jabbar, one of the people injured in the attack, described what happened.
I was going inside the station after buying a train ticket. After 2 minutes, as I reached inside on the platform, there was a blast. Two more people who were with me got injured. There were more people with me. God knows what happened to them.
Well, the separatist group, the Balochistan Liberation Army, said it was responsible for the blast. The commissioner of Quetta, Hamza Shafakat, told reporters that the militants must be defeated.
The terrorists attack the soft targets through frustration. They frequently attack soft targets. When their people are arrested, they also attack in retaliation. We all have to fight this war. We are resilient, which you can see through our responses. All our teams reach the victims and are trying to save as many lives as they can.
Well, the BBC's correspondent in Pakistan, Caroline Davis, joins us now from the capital, Islamabad. Caroline, just give us the latest information on this attack.
Well, I've been speaking to one of the police investigating officers who was on the scene very shortly after this explosion. He says that this is very early on in their investigation, but on his sort of initial assessment, he thought that this was, as you say, a suicide bomber. That is what police have been saying this morning. He thinks that this individual carried between 6 to 8 kilograms of explosives into the crowd that were waiting at Quetta Station. Now, there is some CCTV footage of the moment of this explosion as well. And just before the explosion happens, in the moments before, you can see people who are milling around. There's about 150 or so who are waiting on this platform to get a train to go from Quetta to Peshawar. It's at about 8:15 in the morning, and people are sitting with their packing cases, milling around, waiting for the train that was meant to leave at 8:30. This is the point at which the explosion happens. You see a flash of light, then you see a flash of orange flame that comes from the explosion. You can see bodies that are thrown with the force of that explosion, and then the entire platform is covered in a cloud of dust and debris, and the people who are able to then begin to try to run to leave the scene as quickly as possible. There is also footage of the aftermath of this explosion as well, which really shows the true devastation of what happened. There are sort of bodies littered around the station, around the platform edges, people trying to help, trying to gather up those injured to try to take them to hospital. And of course, we have now been told by the authorities in Quetta that 25 people died, and they estimated at least 50 people were injured. And amongst those 25 people killed, they say that there is the suicide bomber. But they also say that there are some military personnel as well as civilians amongst those that were killed this morning.
Right. Is it clear then that this bomb attack was trying to target those military personnel?
That is what the Balochistan Liberation Army have said. They put out a statement on their social media channels this morning and emailed journalists as well. And they explained this by saying that they were targeting military that had been on a training course in Quetta and that were then catching this train to travel back. But of course, what we have heard from quite a lot of the authorities is the fact that even though there might have been a military that had been involved in this, that civilians were caught up in this explosion as well. And we've heard, as you say, from the chief minister talking about soft targets being hit. This is a main train station in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan, which is, while we have seen a rising number of attacks from the BLA, the fact that this was in the heart of Quetta has been something that's also been quite shocking to a lot of people.
And this is just the latest of a series of deadly attacks in the province this year.
Yes, and back in August, there was an incident where there were 22 people who were killed. They were taken off these were people who were travelling in a convoy, who were taken off a coach, rounded up and then shot. At the same time, there were multiple other attacks that happened all on exactly the same day. We've seen images of, again, sort of train structure of bridges that had been detonated and exploded as well. That was in August. And then month we also had an incident that happened in Karachi that the BLA took responsibility for. That's when two Chinese nationals were killed just outside Karachi's airport. The Chinese nationals who were engineers were killed when there was a vehicle that had explosives piled up onto it that drove into them as well. BLA took responsibility for that too. So okay. Yes, we're seeing increasing number of these attacks from BLA.
Caroline Davis in Islamabad, thank you. Well, to find out more about Balochistan and the Balochistan Liberation Army, I've been talking to Dr. Fazana Sheikh from the international think tank Chatham House in London.
Well, the province of Balochistan is located in the southwest of Pakistan. It is the least populated of Pakistan's four provinces. It is the richest in natural resources. It has vast mineral resources in particular, but it is also the most impoverished of Pakistan's four provinces, which points to what this insurgency, which started pretty much with the inception of the state in 1947, is all about. There is a great sense of grievance that the resources of the province have been funneled elsewhere and that the people of Balochistan have benefited very little from the dividends of these resources.
And so what does the Balochistan Liberation Army, the BLA, which is regarded as a terrorist organization by many Western governments, what do they want?
Well, essentially, their stated aim is secession. Basically, it has campaigned, you know, for many, many years for the province to be given greater autonomy and to be master of its own destiny and particularly to be in control of its own resources. And over time, of course, it met with resistance from successive central governments and has finally reached this point where it believes that secession is the only way out. And it is now increasingly seen as a group that is actually voicing the sentiments of vast swathes of the Baloch population.
You say vast swathes. Is it possible to gauge what level of support secession has in the province?
Well, in terms of how much support secession actually enjoys, is difficult to tell. But I think what we are seeing is a distinct shift in the province amongst groups that certainly are not engaged in the kind of violence that one associates with the BLA. These groups now are increasingly coming around to the view that the only way forward is for the province really to be given autonomy. You know, it is difficult to tell exactly the degree of support, but I think it is fair to say that today there is a majority in the province that believes that secession may be the only way out in the absence of any kind of political agreement or negotiation with the political and military establishment.
And have there been any talks between Balochistan and the capital, Islamabad, about any kind of increased autonomy?
No, I think that's really the most worrying part of this crisis. I mean, we have seen as recently as June yet another attempt to put together a counter-terrorism program that would be directed at Baloch militants. But we have seen absolutely nothing nor heard anything of any political program to address these grievances.
So you're saying there should be political talks alongside the security response?
There's no doubt about that. Yes, yes. It's clear that brute force and a militarized approach to this crisis is not going to end with the kind of result that is wanted by any side involved in this crisis. The only way forward would be political negotiations.
Dr. Fazana Sheikh there from Chatham House in London. Now, one of the most immediate global challenges facing the US president-elect Donald Trump is the war in Ukraine, sparked by Russia's full-scale invasion of its neighbour almost 3 years ago. Russia's deputy foreign minister has said that Moscow is ready to listen to Mr. Trump's proposals on Ukraine. Speaking to the BBC, a senior advisor to Donald Trump's campaign has said the aim of ending the war is about finding peace, not winning back Ukrainian territory. Brian Lanza has been speaking to NewsHour's Paul Henley, who asked him first of all if the next administration will pull the US out of the Western military alliance, NATO.
President Trump's going to have a stern conversation with the European leaders. They have a difficult choice to make. If you really believe in the values of NATO, you would not be funding war machines. You would not be funding Russia's war machines. You would not be expanding, you know, China's communist rule in places. And so, yeah, I think if NATO and the nation states understand what's at stake, you'll have a partner in President Trump. But if they go back to the mentality where they don't have to contribute and they're going to fund these war machines, the American people shouldn't invest if Europe doesn't want to invest themselves. But history will not be kind on Europe for making these dumb decisions at the end of the day.
Vladimir Putin seems to agree with Mr. Trump that he might be able to end the war in Ukraine. How?
Listen, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the Ukrainian people. They've proven over the last couple of years that their hearts are made of lions. Europe needs Ukrainian people to protect them as well. I mean, these citizens know how to fight Russia. They've done it successfully. Now, the challenge becomes, when you have an honest conversation with your partners, is, you know, what are the goals? Zelensky, for example, he says his goal is to get Crimea back. Well, that's not the goal of the United States, and that's not the goal of the European nation states. We learned that in 2014, that when Putin invaded Crimea, Europe did nothing. And so now when Zelensky says, you know, we will only stop this fighting, there will only be peace once Crimea is returned, we've got news for President Zelensky. Crimea is gone. And if that is your priority of getting Crimea back and having American, you know, soldiers fight to get Crimea back, you're on your own. That is not the priority of America. But the priority of America is peace and to stop the killing.
And does that include stopping arms deliveries to Ukraine immediately as things stand?
Listen, I think Ukraine has a choice it needs to make. It has to decide what it wants to do with this war.
So if Ukraine says, and it sounds unlikely at the moment, but if Ukraine were to say, right, we give up Crimea, they'd carry on getting the arms for the rest of the battle, would they?
Listen, the reality on the ground is the European nation states and President Biden did not give Ukraine the ability and the arms to win this war at the very beginning and failed to lift the restrictions for Ukraine to win. And so, you know, those are the challenges. What we're going to say to Ukraine is, you know, what do you see as a realistic vision for peace? It's not a vision for winning, but it's a vision for peace. And let's start having the honest conversation. And if President Zelensky comes to the table and says, well, we can only have peace if we have Crimea, he shows to us that he's not serious.
Trump campaign adviser Brian Lanza there. We're yet to hear a response from officials in Kiev to that, but Italy's Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini's just been talking about it, saying that Donald Trump should receive the Nobel Peace Prize if he succeeds in ending the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. That update and others on the US election live page running at bbc.com. Coming up, Germany marks 35 years since the Berlin Wall fell. One East German native reflects on what has happened since the end of the old German Democratic Republic, or GDR.
Life changed drastically and forever for all East Germans. A quarter of us left the former GDR since 1990. When we return for Christmas, we find empty streets, closed shops and hardened faces. But we also find efforts to rebuild communities, beautifully restored houses, and a sense of belonging that never really quite lets you go.
A reminder of our main headlines. A separatist group in western Pakistan says it carried out a suicide attack at a railway station that has killed at least 25 people. And the United Nations says 1.4 million people in South Sudan are now affected by severe floods. This is Rob Young with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. For months, there's been concern about the availability of food in the Gaza Strip as Israel continues to be accused of limiting what enters the territory that has been shattered by a year of war. The Famine Review Committee, which is made up of food security experts from around the world, has just issued a rare alert, warning that there's a strong likelihood that famine is imminent in areas within the north of the Gaza Strip. One United Nations official has described the situation in the north as apocalyptic as a wide Israeli military offensive continues in the area. Well, Israel said last month that the problem in Gaza was not a lack of aid, saying a million tons had been delivered over the past year. Amjad Al-Shawa is the director of the Palestinian NGOs network. He's in Deir al-Balah in Gaza. and told me what information he has on the daily availability of food in the north of the Strip.
In the north, there is no availability. There is nothing. 35 days and no supplies entered to the north of Gaza Strip, where it's 100,000 people are still there. Medical supplies, no food, no water is entering for drinking.
What are people doing then? What are they managing to eat day to day?
They have stored some canned foods and things which were they used to receive from different organizations. And they, you know, they continue their, you know, to keep alive with the minimal level of things that they can get.
The United States told the Israeli government to allow more aid, particularly food aid, into Gaza or face potential consequences. Are you aware of an increase in the number of lorries getting into Gaza to deliver aid?
No. What we witnessed is more restrictions, not releasement of aid, more escalation with full meaning targeting the civilians. And what I'm saying this collectively now, it's on all areas of Gaza Strip. The last month, in October, we only have 30 trucks a day of humanitarian aid from different items, whether it's shelters or shelter items or food. We're in bad need for 700, 800 trucks a day in order to respond to the huge needs result from the destruction, mass destruction. I cannot, you know, I had this statement from the U.S. administration from the beginning of this war. Until now, there is nothing.
You said earlier on that Israel targets civilians. Israel says that it tries to minimize damage to civilians and accuses Hamas of hiding among civilians. It also accuses Hamas militants of hijacking deliveries of aid. Is that something you've seen?
What I've seen that nothing justifies killing any of the civilians.
But have you seen Hamas militants take aid that's been delivered?
I'm not being there in order to witness. What I witnessed, patients in the corridors, doctors trying and medical teams trying to save the lives of these hospitals.
You talked about the urgent need for more deliveries into the Gaza Strip. That does appear to be unlikely. Is there anything else that can be done to try to avoid this famine, not just in the north, but the other shortages of food that you've been talking about elsewhere in the Gaza Strip?
What we could be done is not only to allow entry of the food items, because the world didn't want to see the famine in Gaza. Also, killing of these children, by all means, must supposed be stopped. This war is supposed to be stopped and end, to have an end for it.
Amjad Al-Shawa there from the Palestinian NGOs Network. Now, youth crime has become a big talking point in Australia, with new governments in the Northern Territory and Queensland recently winning elections after campaigning on bringing down what they say are soaring crime rates. Well, one of the first things the Northern Territory's new government did when it took power was to lower the age of criminal responsibility to just 10 years old. That is in line with most of Australia and also England and Wales, but goes against the pressure to raise the age in line with other developed countries and United Nations advice. Experts say the move is dangerous, goes against the evidence, and will only make the situation worse. Our Australia correspondent Katie Watson reports from Darwin.
The idea that in order to support a 10-year-old you have to criminalise them is irrational, ineffective, and morally bankrupt. We're not going to stand for it.
Outside Parliament last month, demonstrators in Darwin made a last-ditch effort to turn the political tide. It was the day the newly elected Country Liberal Party fast-tracked a series of bills to tackle youth crime in the Northern Territory.
There were about 100 people standing outside, many with placards. One reads, 10-year-olds still have baby teeth. Others saying, stop youth in detention. Don't lock up kids.
A snap three-day curfew has been declared in Alice Springs in response to a crime wave, including an 80-person
brawl. If you are a child under 18 and unaccompanied, the police will remove you. It's a curfew that will last from 6...
Residents say they feel unsafe. Youth offender rates have risen since COVID, but they're still about half of what they were 15 years ago. No matter, politicians are playing to the fear.
This outlet broken in five times?
Five times.
Five to six times, yeah.
Sunil Kumar owns a couple of Indian restaurants in Darwin. He voted for the Country Liberal Party, fed up with children damaging his property. Sunil's added cameras and offers kids loitering outside a soft drink, trying to engage them.
How come they're out from home and parents doesn't know? So supposed to be have to punish for parents.
Come on through. So this is our rec room here. Kids come in here and can relax.
Across town, I meet Darren Damaso, a youth leader, a brother to another, an Aboriginal-led project that mentors First Nations people caught up in the youth justice system. Because that's the issue. In the Northern Territory, while around 30% of the population are Aboriginal, almost all young people locked up here are Indigenous.
By locking these kids up, it's just a reactive way to go about it. There needs to just be more rehabilitative support services, more funding towards Aboriginal-led programs, because they actually understand what's happening for these families.
Are you around for a chat? Shall we come in here?
Thomas, not his real name, is being supported by brother to another. He's 18 and diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. He's been locked up repeatedly since he was 13. His younger brothers are on a similar path.
All my family, like most of my family's been in and out of jail. They just see the things that we're doing, think we're bad people because what we do, you know. With my boys, I feel safe with them.
Tonight's result is a victory for hope and opportunity for everyone.
The Northern Territory's new Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro, argues that by lowering the age of criminal responsibility, they can, in her words, intervene early and address the root causes of crime.
What history will show is that tonight was the turning corner of the youth crime crisis.
A similar argument was used during the recent Queensland elections, their campaign, Adult Time for Adult Crime. Experts, though, have rubbished that idea. Which is why there's a growing push to fund early intervention in the traditional sense.
There is huge cultural differences between Indigenous and Western cultures.
Erin Riley is Regional Director for Children's Ground, which works with young children, delivering workshops on their ancestral land.
We centre Indigenous worldviews and Indigenous values. We work in a way that works for Aboriginal people. We know that the systems, you know, the education system and health systems don't work for our people.
Neither do the prison systems, but crime makes headlines, tough policing wins votes, and the country's Indigenous communities continue to bear the brunt.
Katie Watson there reporting from Darwin, the capital of Australia's Northern Territory. A reminder, you can listen to NewsHour whenever you like. We've got two editions a day. You can find the latest online at bbcworldservice.com or wherever you usually get your downloads. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, it is a biopic with a difference, a new film telling the story of the life of the musician Pharrell Williams, the writer and performer of one of the biggest international hits of the past 10 years, Happy. And it gives you a hint of what is to come in its title, Piece by Piece. Everybody who features in it is animated as a Lego model. That includes Pharrell himself, the film's director, Morgan Neville, and also at various points, Justin Timberlake, Jay-Z and Gwen Stefani. Only their voices are real. Well, Morgan Neville has been telling Julian Warwicker why this was a story best told with Lego.
This film, in a way, is how Pharrell thinks, which is, if I'm going to tell my story, I want to do it in a way that feels different and imaginative and true to me. And for him, that meant Lego. And for me, as a filmmaker, that was the key that got me really excited about trying to figure out what that actually meant.
Having settled on that approach, were there any moments where you felt restricted by the medium that you had chosen to make this film out of?
Many. I mean, the thing about Lego is it's a low-resolution animation form. You know, a minifig is only a couple of pieces, and a minifig has no nose, it has no ears, it can't cry or sweat, and they don't bend. And in a way, I think those limitations became part of the fun of it. I mean, to the point where we even started kind of making jokes about the limitations of Lego. You know, there are no thumbs or fingers in Lego. So we started making jokes about that.
On the other side of the coin, did it enable you to do things that you wouldn't perhaps have done if it had been a more orthodox approach to a biopic?
Yeah, absolutely. you could time travel through the animation in a way that puts you in the moment when somebody's recording a song for the first time. You're there in the vocal booth with them, or you're there at the moment of creation, which is something you couldn't normally do in a documentary. But also there's something about the Lego form that I think most people have some kind of emotional connection to. I mean, I still haven't totally figured it out, but I think people have been watching the film and feeling that the film is speaking to them in some childlike way.
On the relationship with Lego, I mean, clearly they come out of this rather nicely as well, commercially. I mean, did you have any doubts, any reservations about that aspect of making it this way?
The first meeting we had was with Lego, because if they had said no, there wouldn't have been a film. To their credit, you know, within 5 minutes, they said, we kind of love this idea. They knew that this film was going to push them in ways that were uncomfortable. I mean, we agreed up front that we weren't going to make what they say in the States is an R-rated movie, you know, an adult movie. But at the same time, we weren't going to do a G-rated movie for kids. It had to have some edge to it. And it had to explore different skin tones and hairstyles than Lego had before. And they said that was a conversation they actually were looking forward to having. And one of the great things is that Lego now is actually manufacturing new skin tones because of this film.
Morgan Neville there, the director of Piece by Piece, talking to Julian Warica.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Rob Young. Now, since Donald Trump's election victory earlier this week, he has reiterated his campaign pledge to carry out the mass deportation of millions of people living illegally in the United States. Crossings over the Mexican border soared to record numbers under Joe Biden's time in office, while the Trump plan would be a huge undertaking, which critics say would damage businesses and break up families. But Donald Trump received a large increase in support from migrant communities who seem to have confidence in what he's promising to do for the economy. Emma Vardy reports from the state of Arizona.
At Jorge's Garage, a family car business in Phoenix, there's Latino music on the radio and several big shiny pickup trucks with enormous tires raised up being worked on. Donald Trump had succeeded in winning over many Latino workers like Jorge Gonzalez, whose family moved to the U.S. from Mexico 20 years ago.
I think he has the right tools for the job. He knows the right people. He knows how to make money. He has something to prove. I think those are ingredients for a good recipe.
What do you think when he promises to carry out mass deportations?
Statistically, that's impossible. He's not going to be able to deport 12 million people that are here illegally. You learn to develop a thick skin, especially coming from where we come from. We don't pay attention to a lot of the things that people say because we know those are just words.
Jorge's father, the big boss here, has come to the same conclusion.
Como persona, no me gusta.
As a person, I don't like him, but as a politician, I like how he ran the economy. Some Latinos think he managed the country better.
Here in downtown Phoenix, the walls are painted with murals depicting the struggles and the journeys of immigrants. And you can tell this is an issue this place feels very close to and that it struggles with. There are obviously efforts here to try to get people to see the human side of this through the politics.
We're splurging today.
The Villalobos family and their friends have made America their home for generations. And there's despair at the prospect of the return of Donald Trump.
I really had hope for humanity, and I feel like we were let down.
As Monica passes around the empanadas, the conversation turns to what will happen to many friends and families who have members of their households who are undocumented migrants.
You have mixed status households, right? And so when you threaten one member of a family, you threaten an entire family and you threaten an entire community.
Do you think it will change the atmosphere for the America that you live in for Latino communities?
Absolutely. You're masking anti-immigrant sentiment and racism, and you're dressing it up really pretty and calling it border security. It's emboldening the worst of us. And that sentiment is felt on the street, it's felt at work, it's felt at schools. It is something that we have to fight every single day. And it's exhausting to be resilient this long.
I feel terrible and
I feel powerless.
Monica's niece, Alexandra, who's a 19-year-old university student, believes deportations could tear apart communities.
When we talk about undocumented migrants here, who are they to you?
It's your neighbors. It's the people you see in the grocery store. To know that those people are in danger and their families could be torn apart at any moment now, it's terrifying and it's heartbreaking.
Legal aliens are stampeding into America by
We will do large deportations. We're going to get these people out.
There are an estimated 12 million undocumented migrants in the U.S., many of whom have lived and worked here for decades. Donald Trump could use his presidential powers to order mass deportations, using the police, the military and border officials to track down and arrest migrants. But it may be costly and time-consuming and is likely to face legal challenges.
Well, I was a sheriff under President Trump. I was a sheriff under this administration. Night and day difference.
I've come to a local law enforcement training centre. There's some training of recruits going on right now. And I've come to meet the local sheriff, Mark Lamb, who knows all too well what the challenges are of policing a border state.
Once you start holding people accountable, securing the border, you're going to start to see a lot of these folks will go back on their own. And then we can start to go after, I think we go after the criminals, people that are causing problems in communities, gang members, people that were vetted or weren't vetted. We find those, and I think really that's how you have to start.
But in Arizona, where hundreds of miles of desert borders Mexico, the task is enormous.
I don't think anybody has the resources right now. So what that looks like, that's what President Trump's going to have to really line out and define, and the people he picks are going to really have to figure out what that looks like.
Sheriff Mark Lamb there, ending that report by Emma Vardy in Arizona. Well, the U.S.'s political parties continue to analyze the results of the election. The losing Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris, did better than Donald Trump among young voters, but her support from that age group fell compared to Joe Biden in 2020. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy has spent the past couple of weeks in Wisconsin, a swing state won by Mr. Trump, by less than 1%. He went to Waukesha, just outside the city of Milwaukee, to meet some first-time voters.
I'm standing on the campus of Carroll College. It's a private Presbyterian college here in Waukesha. It's a glorious autumnal day, and you can probably hear the soundtrack of the leaf blower just on the other side of the square where we are. This is a college that was founded by one of the lesser-known signatories of the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll, and we have come here to talk to some students to reflect on the results of the election.
I'm Aaron Esser. I study political science and pre-law.
My name is Dylan Pfaffenbach. I'm a business administration major.
So, how did you vote and why?
So I voted for Kamala Harris and Democratic all the way down the ballot.
Any doubt about that?
The Democratic Party, while I don't fully align with their values because I'm farther left-leaning than the Democratic Party, I believe that they supported more of both the social and economic policy vision that I have for this country. So that's why I voted the way I did.
For starters, I voted for Donald J. Trump. And I voted for Donald Trump because in 2025, he's going to do three things. Right? He's going to close the southern border and bring back national security to this country. He's going to unleash American energy and bring us back to the energy independence we were at under his presidency. And three, he's going to work tirelessly to end the foreign wars. And it's not just to make America great again, it's to make the world a better place.
Donald Trump seemed to do a better job connecting with young voters. What did he get right and what did Kamala Harris get wrong?
Trump put out actual, like, things people care about. Like, I want to get out of college. I want to be able to afford housing. I want to be able to start a family, right? Like, the American dream just became unachievable under President Biden, right? And it's not just inflation. It's the mortgage rates, the cost of housing, right? And this is what young men care about.
I think the Democratic Party has heard young voters, but they have not listened. And those are two very different things. They'll hear what we're saying and they go, that's great, but you're a child. Move on. But I think they need to realize that we are entering the workforce now. We are getting educated. We are stepping out into the world, and we are the future. So I think there is something to be said about, you know, the tyranny of the majority, and you can't just willy-nilly listen to every, you know, single fad that people are talking about. But I do think that there are actual issues that people in, you know, the 18 to 35 voter demographic are bringing up that aren't being heard and listened to.
We are in a state which is still divided. It's still less than 1%. That won it for Donald Trump in this state. We're having this civilized conversation amongst students, young folks. I mean, can this all remain civilized? Can America come together after this election, do you think?
One politician I follow, he had ran for president in the Republican primary, Vivek Ramaswamy. He said the best way we can get over this polarization is by operating on the same reality, right? I think there's too many buzzwords going around, number one. Is Kamala Harris a communist? No. Is Donald Trump a fascist? No. It's really just all politics. But when people start believing that, that's when the issues occur. That's when we have stuff like extreme events like January 6th happen. That's when we have massive riots happen in 2020. When we take things in politics too far, a lot of it is responsible to the leaders for their demeanor, right?
It's interesting the point Dylan was making about realities. I mean, sharing a reality, because that's one thing a lot of people say, that, you know, Democrats and Republicans have essentially been living in different realities. Can you share the same reality?
I think we can, but I think the big part of it is having difficult conversations. And I think surrounding yourself with people that don't believe the same things as you is important. Like, Dylan is one of my closest friends, and we are ideologically opposed on almost every issue. And I think if you only surround yourself with people who believe the same things as you, you're going to end up in an echo chamber. And that's how people's extreme views get realized.
Students Erin and Dylan speaking to James Kumarasamy in Waukesha County, Wisconsin. Now, to a mystery above our heads, the UK's oldest satellite is thousands of kilometres away from where it should be, and nobody seems to know why. Hopefully somebody who can talk us through this is Rachel Hill, a PhD candidate in science and technology at University College London, who's closely studied the satellite in question, which is called Skynet 1A. Welcome to the programme, Rachel. Just tell us why this satellite is important historically.
So the history of Skynet is essentially the history of the UK in space. It's launched in 1969. Conversations about it were happening much earlier than that. And it has been pretty much a continuous presence in space since that time. So Skynet is still operational. We're on Skynet 5 at the minute, and Skynet 6 will be launched soon. It's also about the militarization of outer space and the role that the UK has played in that process. It's also a satellite that happens at the time of the end of the British Empire. So it's a moment where the UK is really trying to recalibrate what its identity is, both at home and on the world stage. Satellites at the time served as both practical assets for communication, but also were a symbol of national prestige. So satellites, being some of the most cutting-edge technologies at the time, mean that Skynet 1 demonstrated that the UK was a modern and forward-looking nation.
Okay, and so, this satellite is meant to be above one part of the Earth, but is thousands and thousands of kilometres away above another part. How did it get there?
Well, that is the conundrum, and it's a bit of a treasure hunt that I'm currently engaged in, and along with a number of other people in the Skynet community. I've been going through the logs from RAF Okanga, which has been a nerve centre for Skynet from the beginning, and so far, I found that in 1977, there was a final sighting by RAF Okanga of the satellite, and that command was then transferred to the US Air Force, to their satellite command facility. So that's as far as we've got so for now.
Do satellites drift when they're in orbit? Could it just be that it's been there up so long, it's been moving incrementally, nobody noticed till now?
Well, it's a geosynchronous satellite, so they already kind of move in a figure of eight shape as part of their operation. It's part of the mystery is that it seems extremely unlikely that it could have drifted this far. It's in a gravity well, so, and it's very far away from where it should be or where we would estimate
that it would
be.
You're looking at whether someone has deliberately moved it then. Thanks very much indeed. Rachel Hill there, who's a PhD candidate in science and technology at University College London. You can see a map on the BBC website of where the satellite's supposed to be and where it currently is. This is Rob Young with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. To Lebanon now, and Israel's campaign against Hezbollah militants has led to the displacement of around 1.2 million people across the country, Almost 500,000 used to live in Beirut's southern suburbs, an area controlled by Hezbollah. The area has been repeatedly hit by Israeli airstrikes, and almost all residents have left. Our Middle East correspondent Ugo Beshega has joined a rare tour organised by Hezbollah to see the scale of the destruction.
Hezbollah has taken journalists on a media tour of Dahir, which used to be the beating heart of the group in Beirut. This is a site that was hit in an airstrike, and there's still smoke rising from the rubble. A building has been completely destroyed, and there's a lot of destruction everywhere. It gives us a sense of the power of the attack that happened here. Nobody's living here, and this has been the situation in Dahir for weeks as this conflict intensified. Nearly 500,000 people used to live here, and it is now a ghost town.
Zainab.
Zainab, do you live here?
Yes.
Yeah. What have you picked up here?
We want to bring my outfit and my toy.
What's your name?
My name is Samah Mughni. I'm going to take some goods from the house, especially books, because my kids are studying online, and a little bit of their clothes.
How's your flat?
Everything is broken, destroyed, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. We are safe, and we are sure that we're going to win.
Are you going to come back once the war is over?
Sure, we're coming back. From the minute the bombing stops, we're going to go back to our homes, even if we have only walls.
And now, driving through the streets of Dahir, we're being escorted by armored men on mopeds, dozens of them here. And the streets are empty, all the shops are closed. There are no cars, no one.
This is a tightly controlled visit, but it is a rare opportunity to see the destruction caused by weeks of Israeli airstrikes. Clearly, Hezbollah has a message here with this tour. They want to show that these are residential buildings, civilian buildings being hit. Israel says it is targeting Hezbollah assets, Hezbollah infrastructure with these attacks, but we've seen the immense destruction not only here in Dahir but across the country from this massive air campaign by the Israeli military.
We've now been taken to a different location. There's a lot of destruction everywhere, and lots of pictures of fighters who've been killed in this conflict, lots of posters remembering Hassan Nasrallah, the longtime Hezbollah leader who was killed in an Israeli airstrike here in Dahir back in September. This is the last stop of this tour, and we find somebody here. A man, Shu Ismark, what's your name?
Hassan.
Hassan, Anta Sakunhun, do you live here?
Yes.
What do you think about the situation?
This is all residential. There aren't any political party offices here, not even Hezbollah. We were surprised when this building was targeted and destroyed. There are only civilians here. That's a school. This is a residential building.
We've been here for about an hour, and now an Israeli drone is flying overhead. So it's probably time for us to leave.
Ugo Beshega there, reporting from Beirut. Now today, it's 35 years since this moment in history.
East Germany has finally given up trying to control its people. 50,000 have fled through Czechoslovakia in the past week. From now on, they'll be able to cross directly into West Germany with a minimum of formalities. The bombshell announcement, which reverses 40 years of hardline policy, came from the Politburo spokesman, Gunter Schabowski.
This movement of people is going on over a friendly country, which isn't at all easy for that country. And therefore we've decided to invoke a ruling which would allow every citizen of the East German Republic to emigrate through East German border posts.
The BBC's Brian Hanrahan there reporting from Berlin on November the 9th, 1989, on the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, 35 years on, Katja Hoyer, a German historian, reflects for us on what's happened since in her native eastern part of Germany.
On the 7th of October 1989, I was 4 years old, a little girl with unruly pitch black hair. I was excited because my parents had taken me to see the highest building in all of Germany, East Berlin's television tower. On the rotating panorama platform, I went unusually quiet as I gazed down the 203 meters at the streets below. Delighted with the spectacle, I turned around and shouted, maybe slightly too loudly, "Papa, come and see! All those people look like little ants. And look, there are lots of police cars everywhere." That got my father's attention. Looking down at the increasingly crowded square at the foot of the Fernsehturm, his face went white. He recognized the armored vehicles as belonging to paramilitary People's Police units. Many of the people I was pointing at were protesters. That day, 7th of October 1989, was the anniversary of the foundation of East Germany. A month later, on the 9th of November 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. East Germans were free to travel, free to vote, free to experience the opportunities of capitalism, and of course its pitfalls. The Berlin Wall fell 35 years ago. Today, my father is no longer alive, and his daughter lives in the UK, the country that invented capitalism. Life changed drastically and forever for all East Germans. A quarter of us left the former GDR since 1990. When we return for Christmas, we find empty streets, closed shops, and hardened faces. But we also find efforts to rebuild communities, beautifully restored houses, and a sense of belonging that never really quite lets you go. 35 years is a long time for wounds to heal or to fester. East and West Germans still live differently. They vote differently. They even eat differently. They share the wealth of their country unevenly, and they carry different historical baggage. The Berlin Wall may have been down much longer than it was ever up, but the scar it left behind will take much longer still to fade.
German historian and journalist Katja Hoyer there on the fall of the Berlin Wall 35 years ago and what life is like today in East Germany. Well, that is it for this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for listening.